Sketches New and Old, Part 7. First Interview with Artemus Ward. Written about 1870. I had never seen him before. He brought letters of introduction from mutual friends in San Francisco, and by invitation I breakfasted with him. It was almost religion, there in the silver mines, to precede such a meal with whiskey cocktails. Artemus, with the true cosmopolitan instinct, always deferred to the customs of the country he was in, and so he ordered three of those abominations. Hingston was present. I said I would rather not drink a whiskey cocktail. I said it would go right to my head, and confuse me so that I would be in a helpless tangle in 10 minutes. I did not want to act like a lunatic before strangers. But Artemis gently insisted, and I drank the treasonable mixture under protest, and felt all the time that I was doing a thing I might be sorry for. In a minute or two I began to imagine that my ideas were clouded. I waited in great anxiety for the conversation to open, with a sort of vague hope that my understanding would prove clear, after all, and my misgivings groundless. Artemis dropped an unimportant remark or two, and then assumed a look of superhuman earnestness, and made the following astounding speech. He said, "Now there is one thing I ought to ask you about before I forget it. You have been here in Silverland, here in Nevada, 2 or 3 years, and, of course, your position on the Daily Press has made it necessary for you to go down in the mines and examine them carefully in detail, and therefore you know all about the silver mining business. Now what I want to get at is, the way the deposits of ore are made, you know. For instance. Now, as I understand it, the vein which contains the silver is sandwiched in between casings of granite, and runs along the ground, and sticks up like a curbstone. Well, take a vein 40 feet thick, for example, or 80, for that matter, or even 100, say you go down on it with a shaft, straight down, you know, or with what you call incline maybe you go down 500 feet, or maybe you don't go down but 200, anyway, you go down, and all the time this vein grows narrower, when the casings come nearer or approach each other, you may say, that is, when they do approach, which, of course, they do not always do, particularly in cases where the nature of the formation is such that they stand apart wider than they otherwise would, and which geology has failed to account for, although everything in that science goes to prove that, all things being equal, it would if it did not, or would not certainly if it did, and then, of course, they are. Do not you think it is?" I said to myself. Now I just knew how it would be. That whiskey cocktail has done the business for me, I don't understand any more than a clam. And then I said aloud. That is, if you don't mind, would you say that over again? I ought.
Oh, certainly, certainly. You see I am very unfamiliar with the subject, and perhaps I don't present my case clearly, but I...
No, you stated plain enough, but that cocktail has muddled me a little. But I will know, I do understand for that matter, but I would get the hang of it all the better if you went over it again and I'll pay better attention this time. He said,
why, what I was after was this. Here he became even more fearfully impressive than ever, and emphasized each particular point by checking it off on his finger ends. This vein, or lode, or ledge, or whatever you call it, runs along between two layers of granite, just the same as if it were a sandwich.
Very well. Now suppose you go down on that, say 1,000 feet, or maybe 1,200, it don't really matter, before you drift, and then you start your drifts, some of them across the ledge, and others along the length of it, where the sulfurets, I believe they call them sulfurets, though why they should, considering that, so far as I can see, the main dependence of a miner does not so lie, as some suppose, but in which it cannot be successfully maintained, wherein the same should not continue, while part and parcel of the same were not committed to either in the sense referred to, whereas, under different circumstances, the most inexperienced among us could not detect it if it were, or might overlook it if it did, or scorn the very idea of such a thing, even though it were palpably demonstrated as such. Am I not right? I said, sorrowfully, I feel ashamed of myself, Mr. Ward. I know I ought to understand you perfectly well, but you see that treacherous whiskey cocktail has got into my head, and now I cannot understand even the simplest proposition. I told you how it would be.
Oh, don't mind it, don't mind it, the fault was my own, no doubt, though I did think it clear enough for.
Don't say a word.
Clear.
Why, you stated it as clear as the sun to anybody but an abject idiot, but it's the confounded cocktail that has played the mischief.
No, now don't say that. I'll begin it all over again, and...
Don't now, for goodness sake,
Don't do anything of the kind, because I tell you my head is in such a condition that I don't believe I could understand the most trifling question a man could ask me. Now don't you be afraid. I'll put it so plain this time that you can't help but get the hang of it. We will begin at the very beginning. Leaning far across the table, with determined impressiveness wrought upon his every feature, and fingers prepared to keep tally of each point enumerated, and I, leaning forward with painful interest, resolved to comprehend or perish, you know the vein, the ledge, the thing that contains the metal, whereby it constitutes the medium between all other forces, whether of present or remote agencies, so brought to bear in favor of the former against the latter, or the latter against the former or all, or both, or compromising the relative differences existing within the radius whence culminate the several degrees of similarity to which. I said, oh, hang my wooden head, it ain't any use. It ain't any use to try, I can't understand anything. The plainer you get it the more I can't get the hang of it. I heard a suspicious noise behind me, and turned in time to see Hingston dodging behind a newspaper, and quaking with a gentle ecstasy of laughter. I looked at Ward again, and he had thrown off his dread solemnity and was laughing also. Then I saw that I had been sold, that I had been made a victim of a swindle in the way of a string of plausibly worded sentences that didn't mean anything under the sun. Artemus Ward was one of the best fellows in the world, and one of the most companionable. It has been said that he was not fluent in conversation, but, with the above experience in my mind, I differ. Cannibalism in the cars. Written aboard 1867. I visited St. Louis lately, and on my way west, after changing cars at Terre Haute, Indiana, a mild, benevolent-looking gentleman of about 45, or maybe 50, came in at one of the way stations and sat down beside me. We talked together pleasantly on various subjects for an hour, perhaps, and I found him exceedingly intelligent and entertaining. When he learned that I was from Washington, he immediately began to ask questions about various public men, and about congressional affairs, and I saw very shortly that I was conversing with a man who was perfectly familiar with the ins and outs of political life at the Capitol, even to the ways and manners, and customs of procedure of senators and representatives in the chambers of the national legislature. Presently two men halted near us for a single moment, and one said to the other, "Harris, if you'll do that for me, I'll never forget you, my boy." My new comrades I lighted pleasantly. The words had touched upon a happy memory, I thought. Then his face settled into thoughtfulness, almost into gloom. He turned to me and said, "Let me tell you a story, let me give you a secret chapter of my life, a chapter that has never been referred to by me since its events transpired. Listen patiently, and promise that you will not interrupt me." I said I would not, and he related the following strange adventure, speaking sometimes with animation, sometimes with melancholy, but always with feeling and earnestness. The Stranger's Narrative. On the 19th of December, 1853, I started from St. Louis on the evening train bound for Chicago. There were only 24 passengers, all told. There were no ladies and no children. We were in excellent spirits, and pleasant acquaintanceships were soon formed. The journey bade fair to be a happy one, and no individual in the party, I think, had even the vaguest presentiment of the horrors we were soon to undergo. At 11 p.m. it began to snow hard. Shortly after leaving the small village of Weldon, we entered upon that tremendous prairie solitude that stretches its leagues on leagues of houseless dreariness far away toward the Jubilee settlements. The winds, unobstructed by trees or hills, or even vagrant rocks, whistled fiercely across the level desert, driving the falling snow before it like spray from the crested waves of a stormy sea. The snow was deepening fast, and we knew, by the diminished speed of the train, that the engine was plowing through it with steadily increasing difficulty. Indeed, it almost came to a dead halt sometimes, in the midst of great drifts that piled themselves like colossal graves across the track. Conversation began to flag. Cheerfulness gave place to grave concern. The possibility of being imprisoned in the snow, on the bleak prairie, 50 miles from any house, presented itself to every mind, and extended its depressing influence over every spirit. At 2 o'clock in the morning I was aroused out of an uneasy slumber by the ceasing of all motion about me. The appalling truth flashed upon me instantly: we were captives in a snowdrift. All hands to the rescue. Every man sprang to obey. Out into the wild night, the pitchy darkness, the billowy snow, the driving storm, every soul leapt, with a consciousness that a moment lost now might bring destruction to us all. Shovels, hands, boards, anything, everything that could displace snow, was brought into instant requisition. It was a weird picture, that small company of frantic men fighting the banking snows, half in the blackest shadow and half in the angry light of the locomotive's reflector. One short hour sufficed to prove the utter uselessness of our efforts. The storm barricaded the track with a dozen drifts while we dug one away. And worse than this, it was discovered that the last grand charge the engine had made upon the enemy had broken the fore and aft shaft of the driving wheel. With a free track before us, we should still have been helpless. We entered the car wearied with labor, and very sorrowful. We gathered about the stoves, and gravely canvassed our situation. We had no provisions whatever, in this lay our chief distress. We could not freeze, for there was a good supply of wood in the tender. This was our only comfort. The discussion ended at last in accepting the disheartening decision of the conductor, viz., that it would be death for any man to attempt to travel 50 miles on foot through snow like that. We could not send for help, and even if we could, it would not come. We must submit, and await, as patiently as we might, succor or starvation. I think the stoutest heart there felt a momentary chill when those words were uttered. Within the hour, conversation subsided to a low murmur here and there about the car, caught fitfully between the rising and falling of the blast. The lamps grew dim, and the majority of the castaways settled themselves among the flickering shadows to think, to forget the present, if they could, to sleep, if they might. The eternal night, it surely seemed eternal to us, wore its lagging hours away at last, and the cold gray dawn broke in the east. As the light grew stronger, the path